This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Murray Middleton challenges us with narratives that raise scenarios and dabble in form in his short story anthology, You Want It Darker. So, Murray, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you, David. I believe it's 11 years between drinks for us on this 11 show.
11 years, because you had, yeah, I just trying to recall. My memory doesn't quite work that well.
I appreciate you've had a lot of guests. So, for the sake of the listeners, it was after I won the Vogel Literary Award. I came in and that was my first collection of short stories that I was spruiking then. And I think I had about 30 interviews in 2 weeks, so it's all a blur to me.
So you can't even remember what I asked last time.
I can remember one question you stumped me live on air, and it was terrifying.
Oh,
it was about the humanity of my characters, and it was actually an angle. I was in my 20s, you know, I hadn't considered that angle, and I tried to sort of politician my way through the answer, and I feel forever regretful that you stumped me on air.
Well, you stumped me during the course of this latest anthology, but let's get into it. You know, I should have realised from the title what I was facing. The letter U is used rather than a pronoun. Now, for an English teacher, I've got chalk dust in my veins. But you actually play on this digital form in the course of the novel. And this is where you stumped me, because there's one story here that threw me. House with White Fence. And as I started reading it, okay, what? Hang on a minute. The narrator has changed. Just briefly explain how, the form of this short story, please.
Absolutely. So the first two stories are more modernist, traditional, elliptical plots. The third story starts out with these bizarre offcuts of sentences, and then over time we slowly realise that it's a user-updated database depicting the demise of a Northside pizzeria in Melbourne. So some listeners may know the pizzeria. This is like fictionalized. And as over the course of the story, we realize even though they are user reviews, there is an actual narrative and a plot as we recognize the slow demise of this polygamous pizza artist.
Is this what they call a feed, or how is it described?
Well, it's like what was once called Zomato. You can look up all these. Oh, no, he's twitching in the studio here.
This language is going as well. I mean, all of this modern terminology. I still use punctuation in text messages and such like. So that's how old I am. So this is why this story threw me. Please explain.
Well, the title's actually based on the title of an Adolf Hitler watercolour painting. And the idea is that even the most horrific people can produce beauty. And if you ever want to look it up, look it up. I think there is beauty in this painting. I would never put it on my own wall. The parallel with the central character in this story is that he himself is guilty of quite a lot, but his pizzas take on this cult following, and they're so juicy and tasty and organic and fresh. So even though most of these online reviews are about how sort of violent he is towards customers, the beauty of his pizza is appreciated by a sort of small niche of Melburnians. So I wanted to talk about the duality of that.
And there's also an arc in that narrative that comes out. You know, people are full of praise and then it gets, well, darker sort of thing. And you get that balance. And, you know, I'm wondering then just how reliable, not your storytelling, but this nature of these feeds that come through online, and how we can actually get a clear narrative on such things.
We absolutely have to question how reliable the feeds are. And my main point of this story is that we have to accept nuance in debate. When we talk about wars, which we're charged at the moment with, we have to accept that there's nuance involved. You can't either be on one side or the other, or if you are, you probably reject a lot of information and there's a lot of like cognitive dissonance there. So in this respect, a lot of people hate the pizza artist. A lot of people see him as beautiful. I would suspect he's probably somewhere in between and all of the above.
But what does it say about our reading, our approach to reading these days, and what the younger generation are actually having to consume? Not pizzas, but literature.
Well, I just wonder what they would make of this story, because I was trying to do something different, and the breakneck nature of the pace of this story, we consider pacing, it's designed to be read like Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders really, really quickly. So the idea is to almost not take a breath and to pound through it in 10 to 12 minutes. Whether that's accomplished, I don't know. But I was hoping this would be a story that would engage readers who otherwise wouldn't come to literature, because they'd recognise the shorthand. And later on in the collection, there's a lot of text as well. So I'm hoping to attract readers in their 20s.
Well, that is a perfect segue into then Where We Come to Fall Apart. And it's set out as a series of text messages and this interaction between siblings there. A brother and sister following a narrative and a birth under lockdown. What's going on here?
Well, this mirrors some of my partner and my birth experience. We had a kid during the COVID and ended up in the neonatal intensive care unit. So that part of it, I feel like I can speak to the parental experience of that and, you know, really the horror of it. But the first, probably you said two-thirds of this story is text message exchange between siblings. And I wanted it to have myriad grammatical errors as well. These are people punching out texts. They're not proofing them as you or I might with our text. And I wanted to build up momentum quickly and actually find a way to show what the experience is like when you just need to text someone at 1 a.m. to keep yourself occupied, because otherwise you are going to go to some pretty dark places in there as the babies are under ultraviolet lights, and you need, this character needs help from his sister just to natter away via text to him.
But also then the sister's response responses in general don't necessarily take in the whole. It's a reaction rather than a discussion.
Yeah. I don't think she always gives the brother the responses he would like, and the reality is most siblings are like that, and if you just want a certain response from people, then that's a one-way communication. So this is a sibling, not a rivalry, it's a dynamic that's charged in some respects and it's got a lot of history there. They ultimately support each other, and I think we explore it in the final part of the story. There's a codependence there that only really comes out, you know, once the text messages cease.
But then you get this, it's not an elongation, but a sort of a musical, rhythmical narrative, which it comes almost as a shock. Nadia stared out over the calmly rippling water towards the purple hump of a faraway mountain. There was a paddleboarder in the distance somewhere between her polished toenails and the mountain. The board blended into the shimmering sea. So it's an elongated narrative, while all the form before has been these abrupt interjections sort of thing. And so getting that contrast is quite startling.
Yeah, well, I think one of the main things that authors struggle with is pacing, because we construct our stories so slowly and methodically that we don't know what it's like to read them, because we get our tentacles in and we go for days and weeks on end. So I want to really create the texts fast, type them out imperfectly, and then get to this second part where it's almost, I think it's the most articulate part of the book. This is someone who's got a really clear internal monologue, and we can follow Nadia's thought passages as she stares out over the ocean and tries to contend with what's happened several years before in COVID. So hopefully it's a story unlike any story ever written before and that anyone's ever read. I know readers did not see that last bit coming. I've never spoken to someone who dislikes it. I think it, as a closer, it hits the mark, that story.
Yeah, but how are we becoming overly familiar with text messaging and losing sight of the narrative that evokes a whole other sensibility?
Yeah. Well, in my second book, or the novel No Church in the Wild, we actually decided to constantly cut across the narrative with text messages. All the characters, something interesting will be happening, and then they'll look at their phone. And that's almost designed to replicate the reading experience, because I think most readers, probably not us three, but most readers would look away if they received a text. I would hate to do that, because you're not doing justice to the writer and how they want their work read.
Mm. Well, I've noticed this with students and such like, that they're glossing over things and taking things in grabs rather than the whole. Does that mean we've got to change what we write for the audience, or try and educate them into how to appreciate a developed narrative?
That's the key question of this book and why I chose to go about it this way. I don't think I can go about it in the more traditional sense. Yes, in the pizza story we spoke about, there's still a traditional three-act structure. So you may term these stories as experimental. There's clear plotting and three-act structure just so we can adhere to form, and then we reject it from that point. So I was just wondering how the hell I could access readers who are under the age of 30 and create something that helps them read really fast and get them engaged in a narrative in a non-traditional way. So this is my attempt to form an olive branch. I have no idea if it's been successful at all, but that's exactly what I was trying to do, because I could write these great, like, lyrical novels. You know, Robbie Arnott's probably one of the best exponents of it in modern day, but how many eyes am I going to get on that if I do it that way? So I felt after the last book, I wanted to do something really daring, and hopefully, if nothing else, this is unlike anything ever before it.
Hmm. Going back, we started with the title, but there was also a subtitle here, Tales of Artists in Despair, which, well, I can we can all identify with it. Jan, you've been on stage, etc., or worked with in the arts industry and such like, and have had to deal with artists of all kinds.
Absolutely, even you.
Especially you.
Oh, thank you. So the narrator, Pav, in this story is in a relationship with Bridget, but was in a relationship previously with, well, was it a relationship with Ulla, an artist? What's the nature of the relationships here?
The dynamic is complex. They actually, it's one of those weird meta moments in interviews where they meet in the loft above 3CR. So there's actually a scene set on the premises here. So there's a stenciling workshop where they meet, and Ulla is a lot more abrasive as an artist. She thinks that her art has to, you know, be really prescriptive, whereas Pav, the main character, is far more removed and staying within quite rigid lines and limiting the imperfections there. So I think it starts with a degree of mutual admiration, but certainly I wouldn't even call it a friendship, because it's not two ways. I don't think the character Ulla really listens ever to anything that's said.
But they're on two different journeys in many ways, because basically Pav, and, well, Bridget, who's his current partner, works for the public service sort of thing. And so there's a sort of regimented, ordered, organised way of... And, of course, Bridget would have supported Pav in his artistic endeavours, but Pav makes a decision to go one way, Ulla another. What's the difference here, that where they go?
Well, sometimes it's a thin line, but in this sense, I thought it was an artist, one who will follow their pursuits as far as it could possibly take them. They take their pursuits all the way, and that would be Ulla's justification for all the actions in that story. And I won't reveal what happens there, but I don't agree with those actions. And I think Pav is an artist who is forever hesitant, doubting, almost confronts a point in life where, do I really have what it takes to do this in relation to everyone around me and make the sacrifices? And I think every artist I know either is willing to make the sacrifice or isn't, and it's permissible why you don't.
Well, but it also, well, the area that we can't actually reveal is the extent to which Ulla takes her art, and the reason then for art, that it actually has to have an expression and an action, whereas Pav is going the other way and sort of saying, well, he packs up his paintbrushes, basically, because he knows he can't make, he can't commit himself to the same level where you forgo your own, forgo your own personality.
Yeah, it's between the wars. I think part of it is caught between the fire of Ulla and whatever Bridget represents, which is like absolute method and self-assurance, and Pav's wedged somewhere between those wars. I don't think it's me, because I probably would be inclined to take it all the way, but a lot of artists, and particularly writers I know, they maybe have the fire for a while and it's doused for any one of a number of permissible reasons as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, making a living could be one.
Well, that's the big one. Are you willing? A lot of the characters in that who inhabit these Collingwood and Fitzroy artist studios, they'll go without sustenance, they'll go without heat and clothes for their pursuits.
But you speak from personal engagement in this arena, don't you?
Yeah, I've had two kids now, so the game's a bit different in terms of what I'll go without and what I'll force others to go without as well. I think when you don't have a family and a partner, you can take it all the way, I think, as we say, in relation to Ulla. And there's something really dark about that, but there's something really honest and pure about it as well.
Or have you lost touch with reality?
Would the individual know if they had? Because this story, the character Ulla in it, that's everything that she does is perfectly permissible in her own reality, but that's not the reality the other characters inhabit as well. So I think a lot of artists are so insular to a point they probably do lose touch with reality. But show me the artist who has this sublime take on reality and adheres to it.
Yeah. But also then, you know, the realities of life, of having to earn a living, there's always somebody better as well, or someone who's hit the zeitgeist, or somebody who's had a stroke of luck, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. So you can't actually pursue a career with sort of pinpoint markers that, yes, I'm a success sort of thing.
Absolutely, because we... In the writing industry, you might say something like Dingo Noir at the moment is big and the publishing houses want it, but there's such a lag factor in conceptualizing an idea, realizing it on the page, publishing it. By the time you publish it, it'll be something else. So if you're forever chasing the zeitgeist, you'll forever be in arrears anyway. That's why I think you're better to pursue what comes to you.
But it also begs the question, because you talk about publishers, but the publishers have a set agenda and program and a spreadsheet of books and genres they need covering. Has that affected you at all, especially with this book?
Yeah, well, as I understand, so this was published by Picador or Pan Macmillan, the Australian branch. So I understand my publisher, Geordie Williamson, this was the last collection he got through acquisitions. So that would be almost 4 years ago now. So that speaks to how hard it is with shorts to get across. I definitely would, in terms of a publishing house, I think I'd be viewed as a passion project at this point. I'm not commercial. I'm not Trent Dalton. I'm not going to turn over that many units. So it has to be a publisher who believes in my work and the quality of my work. I'm a slow burn, I think, to readers. But I think if someone gives me a chance, I definitely would back the quality.
But what responsibility then do publishers have to do these things on the fringes?
That's up to them. To me, there's a huge responsibility because you're not going to unearth anyone, and often the most worthwhile projects are the ones that are on the fringes and they find their right moment. Like, I was even teaching the Paris bunch of modernist writers yesterday, and F. Scott Fitzgerald went to his grave thinking Gatsby was a flop. Like, he never knew what became of Gatsby. So, you know, as far as he was concerned, he existed on the margins, and that was an incredible book.
Well, you know, Wilfred Owen's poetry was never realised until after his death because he was championed by somebody else.
Yeah, now we study Wilfred Owen still to this day in schools as well.
So you've
being
got to...
a female voice here, there hasn't been very much about females, and this is why I'd like to just nudge a little bit of my writing in here, my reading over the holidays. It was Drusilla Modjeska's A Woman's Eye, Her Art by Penguin. And Drusilla quotes an artist creating today, Julie Rapp. Women artists today have to find the strength within us, because not only do they have to compete with each other, they have to compete with the standing against men. And two of the women written about in here are Dora Maar, you might know her as Picasso's muse, and you probably know of Man Ray, a photographer, also about the 1930s. His muse was Lee Miller. Now, both of these people were, they knew of each other, but were both really good photographers in that time of the 1930s around Picasso and all the other names that you would have heard of. And it really was a fascinating read about just how good they were. Anyway, so there you are.
No, I love it. Even this idea of a muse, I was talking about it yesterday. You have Kerouac supposedly writing this manuscript with his singlets being changed and washed, and Hemingway 30 years earlier with his wife looking after his child, cooking meals all day for him. Like, this is not fair. It's not just. It's a preposterous way to live. And it wouldn't hold up by today's standards. So I think we're fortunate that the door has been bashed down by a number of writers over the last, you know, probably 4 or 5 decades as well. And I think, weirdly, in the Australian industry, female writers are dominating and male writers are now shuffled more off to the side. And that's probably fair as well.
Well, to get the balance of perspective that is needed out there, I think it's incredibly important. Actors.
Discuss.
As in one of the short stories here, and I've lost sight of my own notes here, but where are we? It's not Warm Love. It's actually the eponymous one, You Want It Darker.
The titular story,
titular story, where you're talking about actors. And I've seen actors do this, where they lose themselves and think that's appropriate. You know, she looked like an artificial human, which seemed to please her very much and make her more confident in her sickening pale skin. Here's a woman who's basically subsumed or painting on a role in real life, just so she can function in real life. Have you had personal experience of actors?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've made short films, and I'm sure listeners would be familiar with method actors. You know, Daniel Day-Lewis is one of the most well-known method actors. So working with them is just bizarre on set because they inhabit the character even between takes. When you have more than one method actor on set, it is truly absurd, and it's egos clashing constantly. So in this story, I tried to portray a few of those who the line, of course, between character and actor becomes so thin it doesn't even exist anymore. So this is a story. I know the character Annika you're referring to. She almost lights the fire in the central character in the sense because it's the first time he's tried on outfits, assumed dialogue, and he comes to acting much later in life as a result of that. But it's a very perverse relationship and unusual, but I think it weirdly functions on the page.
It is an unusual relationship. I mean, the line I keep quoting is from Laurence Olivier when an actor comes up to him when Laurence Olivier is directing, and you know, Sir Laurence, what is my motivation for doing it this way? And Laurence Olivier replies, your salary. because, you know, this nonsense, but the whole industry in some ways, the film industry especially, it's fragmented. You do scene 5 followed by scene 21 by scene 1, and there's no no connection with reality. It's a whole abstract artificial world.
I don't think viewers often grasp that. It's not chronological at all. It's really hard and fragmented for artists, and they often, you might see a storyboard, but you're not sure always how everything fits into the final cut of the film or what the final cut's going to be as well. So I was trying to portray a really realistic take on being an actor. I worked at the Victorian College of the Arts, so I've seen so many sets, some pretty wild student sets as well. And in this, I wanted to portray the absurdity of someone who's been acting for decades and they get this one tourism ad that in 8 takes gives them more money than 15 years of acting. And that's the nature of these actors. They want to land this big TAC commercial, and that pays for all the passion projects as well. It's kind of like me being a passion project at a publishing house, really, now that I'm talking about it.
I was in a butter menthol set once.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
That paid, was it that one that paid for my trip overseas when I was a student? And that sort of, it's totally unrealistic, but the next moment you can be totally unemployed and waiting on the next gig. So how connected are artists to the real world in that regard?
I think the bizarre thing is the characters where you get scope are the ones that pay you very little, and the butter menthol ads are the ones you get no artistic scope, but they pay the most. And that is the absurdity of art.
But also then the way you've narrated this story, it's almost in a series of single lines, a train of thought. How would you describe it?
It's almost a narrative poem. I think it's 11,000 words right in the dark heart of the collection, which is risky. It was during COVID and I only had 18 letters functioning on my keyboard, so I had to not do paragraphs. So I would, at the end of every writing session, I'd copy and paste the additional 8 letters. So I did about 200 words a day, and that seemed to suit the mania of being in lockdown. So that's the story behind the story.
I can imagine a manuscript written without words.
Another book I read was by Gideon Hay. I don't know whether you know him, but he's got a big name in the cricket world.
Yes.
He writes so much stuff about cricket. And through COVID, he couldn't go to and write anything about cricket. But there was a connection. He wrote a book called The Night Was a Bright Moonlight and I Could See a Man Quite Plainly. And it all had to do with a cricket link. A quote, a man of violent temper who in a fit of jealousy murdered a companion, smashing his head with a cricket bat. And that wasn't the only link. The man was the son of G.F. Vernon, who'd come to Australia to play cricket in the 1880s. And what it was, Gideon Hay went into this most incredibly researched biography of the judge and all the lawyers and all the witnesses, and it was just an interesting read.
Gideon, I actually know Gideon, like extraordinary human being, so, so prolific. Like just look up how many books he's written and the kind of person, I once emailed him on a Friday night just seeking some clarification on a cricket issue. 15 minutes later, 350 words in my inbox. I don't know what he's doing on a Friday night, but straight into it, and just an extraordinary and generous brain, Gideon. Yeah, admirable.
I'm lost for words.
Well, Gideon like never you. Is lost for words, no, let me tell you.
Anything else you've read, Jan?
Well, this was the book that got passed around and everybody read it within 5 days, and because it was the page turner, and it was one that David recommended. It was Sam Guthrie's The Peak.
Oh, yeah.
A very current political espionage.
Yeah.
It was a ripper. So, well, that was my holiday reading.
That was your holiday.
I didn't do any writing. Did you just write or read over holidays, Murray?
Neither. I have not had a creative writing day in 3 years because young kids and I did back-to-back manuscripts, so had the copy, the line, structural edits on both books. And now I'm just reading children's books every night as well. So there's a project I'd like to pursue next year. I won't give any teasers. We'll just see if that happens.
Farm the kids out, get somebody else to look after them so you can get on with the writer's intent. Jen, we're actually going to have to wind
up. I just want to say, this would be a fabulous short story book for VCE students to look at, because it just covers everything.
But also then, yes, to look at form and what makes for good writing, because there is actually a new component in the VCE English looking at creative writing, but what does it constitute? The other problem with it is, how do you assess it? Because people will have different reactions to creative works. Murray, we are actually going to have to wind up, which is a pity, because I had other questions, because you make commentary on modern day things like only people with good fortune of being raved without these slick radio frequency transmitters understand the beauty of thoughts uninterrupted. Yeah, the sort of digital world interrupting
that's
our things.
That's the author coming through there as well.
Yeah. And things like there was Soul Night, where Kat, who had such potential and was in the school musical and got, you know, there are echoes of what she could have achieved, but, you know, she's just sort of serving drinks and things like that. So all of that is in this collection. It's called You Want It Darker. It is a Pan Macmillan release. Good on you, Pan Macmillan, for, you know, these pet projects, these things that do need to balance out what we've got there. And that sort of brings us to the end of our first live show for the year.
It was fascinating. Thank you very much, Murray.
My pleasure, and apologies for the spelling in the title, David.
Well, it's all the spelling in the text messages. I was having conniptions, but there you go. Jan, we've got Resonant Frequency Radio coming in next, so we better play a tune, and that'll allow us to get out of here.
I just want to be myself, but in this life it feels like hell. Like to sing with the birds in the trees. Yeah, I just want to be me. No one says it's gonna be this hard. The world I know is breaking my heart. They never said it was gonna be this hard. Sometimes I wish it all went dark. Wishing away forgotten days, lying in bed like a cave, hoping for